ask me out for something wet. When the vet begins to pet, I cry hooray. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. I've been asked to have a meal by a big tycoon in steel. If the meal includes a deal, accept I may. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. There's an oil man known as Tex, who is keen to give me checks. And his checks, I fear, mean that Tex is here to stay. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. Mr. Harris, plutocrat, wants to give my cheek a pat. If the Harris pat means a Paris hat, baby. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way.
Hello, it's good to talk to you. I think the moment at which Carl Wiley is asked what the law is, and he responds, "I really don't care," is a fine beginning not merely to a poem, but to an acquaintance. I admit that this is pretty much the moment at which I find myself not liking Carl Wiley, for whatever that may be worth. Not because I really don't care, like I really don't care, do you, on the back of Melania Trump's jacket as she went to visit the holding pens where children have been separated from their parents on the border. Not because it's not about caring, but because it is about what indeed the theme of this part of the poem is about, dissociation altogether. But that's not really why I don't find myself liking Carl Wiley at the moment of our acquaintance. It's actually sort of more personal than that, I think. You know what Holmes said it was? The poet asked, what did Holmes say? It was a great anthropological document. A great anthropological document. A great anthropological document. What? The millions of tons of paper generated every year by public offerings? The billions of words written by lawyers every day? How about the Supreme Court? That opinion declaring unconstitutional that Colorado law, the law approved by a statewide referendum by 54% of those voting, the one that says no preferential treatment for queers, no legislation privileging queers. I haven't read, I am never going to read it. Are you? Whoever reads Supreme Court opinions, I know I don't. Now, he's talking, as you no doubt realize, about Romer against Evans. A case he hasn't read, but he does remember the proportion of the voters of the state of Colorado who, by constitutional amendment through referendum, prohibited the municipalities of Colorado from having civil rights ordinances making gay people equal to straight people for purposes of housing, employment, and etc. Romer against Evans is a case in which Pamela Carlin and I filed an amicus brief. I thought it was important then, and I think it was important now. Part, indeed, of a great anthropological document. Not necessarily a very precise legal document in the sense that Justice Kennedy's opinion, which held that the Colorado referendum was unconstitutional because the Equal Protection Clause, because, and I do wish that a little more thought had been given, for example, to the rationale that we proposed, or indeed to any rationale at all, but Romer against Evans is a great part of the anthropological structure of the 21st century in America, in which because Romer, then later Justice Kennedy, found himself making further inroads in favor of equality that allowed, for example, my mother to marry for a second time. Which is, after all, about as much about anthropology as you can get. So it isn't, I think, that Carl Wiley is hostile to queer people. Obviously, it's not his mother trying to get married. But it is part of the breadth of the disdain and the, I know no other word to offer, but bitterness, which is part of how he does his work. In the same way that Robinson is a character drawn from the lives of the criminal defense lawyers of Lower Manhattan in a way that, at least for me, is recognizable, people that I knew, this Carl Wiley is also a beautifully composed set of voices resonating inside a character uniquely his own. And what he thinks is, to the lawyers who do transactions for a living on the island of Manhattan using other people's money and their own time, what he is as much what Robinson is to the criminal defense bar, I think, as can be. Transactional lawyers are transactional people, as Something Split shows, not merely in the personality of Wiley, but in the Greek chorus of Jansen Voorhees and Urquhart that succeeds him. His former associates, the onlookers attached, as Urquhart so perceptively says, to other different, smaller pools of money, but like the big fish, Wiley, sleeping in the bottom of those pools of money and rising to the surface to bite as often as necessary to hold the money and the bonus and all the complaining that follows from it. Wiley's relationship to money, too, of course, is deeply important to the way he behaves. His practice, as you see, involves representing lenders in acquisitions and mergers and other forms of corporate transaction. But he represents lenders. That is to say, his primary goal is, as Urquhart says, to be attached to pools of money. At the end of the 1990s, the East Asian tiger banking money, looking for ways to buy itself into everything from American real estate to American businesses. And in the process, he is, as he likes to point out, a specialist in chaotic levels of complexity over things that will be here today and forgotten tomorrow once they are entombed in the objects called the tombstones, the bound copies of the transaction documents, attractively compressed to fit on the shelf. If you ask me next month what this transaction is that I am doing now in that same way that I have done 120 or 150 before, 10, 12-hour days, 16-hour days, 10 weeks, 5 weeks, and make one mistake and the show is over, And yet, on the other hand, when it's done, heavens, is it done. And despite his dislike for social science, money is not a social institution, the law is not an anthropological document, the home furnishings of the very rich, the people he knows have real money, $100 million money, that tells you, of course, about what it feels like to him to be a fellow with a couple of million dollars and a good income, which might be three-quarters of a million or might be a million a year. At the end of the 1990s, I think I'm with Jensen about this. That's still a highly profitable partnership that made up Sebold Manning. His draw is probably indeed in seven figures. And yet, of course, it isn't real money. The people who have real money are the people who live on Fifth Avenue by the Cooper Hewitt Museum, and whose walls have Picasso and Braque and so Renoir on them. And in that sense, too, he's resentful. Not that he doesn't like their money. Their money is fine, but them, well, you know, as long as they're not lawyers. Carl Wiley does not like to talk about what he does when he meets other lawyers. And while he may feel that it is a clever form of trolling to say he went to Fordham when he went to UVA, it's really that, well, I don't disagree with him. I mean, but it's not that part of the Yale class which makes its money in private practice, which is really insufferable, I think. And yet, from his point of view, they all are, we are. And in our we-ness, I can't help feeling that I'm not only, from Carl Wiley's point of view, a person who gets along with queers and Negroes, but also that I'm a Jew. But maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe he's broader-minded than that. He doesn't seem so, does he, really? But it's not his breadth or narrowness of mind that matters. Not to him. I really don't care, he would say, and I really don't care either. I would say back, our acquaintance is really founded on his work, and his work, as he understands it, is immersion and control of immeasurable chaos, which is, from his point of view, irony. I have to say it isn't mine, whether it's Schlegel's or not. He's not an ironic fellow, isn't Carl Wiley. And I think the poet is beautifully aware of his drugs, his espresso and his Chilean Merlot and his chilled Volvic. The Epicurean's upper downer, he says. Very Epicurean, I am sure. But also, though he is aware of the moment when the hit of the wall of caffeine from the third espresso of the day again illuminates the world around him, though he's tightly tied to his own proprioception, I'm not surprised, and I don't think the poet is surprised either, that his tennis is important to him. As Urquhart says, I like reading, so I don't play golf. Wiley is a man coiled around his tensions, his resentments, his absences of caring, but with an energy that can be placed into the control of his chaos, and which therefore is the talent which he brings to his practice, a real talent, really understood, capable of understanding and also of subduing it, provided, that is, by the mediations of the tennis and the Merlot and the caffeine and the chilled spring water. You can see that Wiley has succeeded in building a structure around his dissociations and that Jack has not, and that this is the purpose of the story between them. And yet, of course, you know, there's no doubt about it that when you're working on deals, if you were really thinking about it, you would know that the deal you're doing is going to hurt thousands of people and their families. And it is important to have a way not to know that, even though you do. Not to know what you sort of know is the function of the psychological process of dissociation, which is a necessary part of how, as human beings, we survive. The ability to take that knowledge and the experience that traumatizes us, that destabilizes our fundamental self-understanding, that destroys our ability to regulate, the need that we experience to do something with that which is unendurable, is part of the price of being human. The broad consciousness and the long memory and the deep capacity for interpretation and understanding means that we need a place to put that which is the toxic waste dump of our psychic lives. And this is a process, the process of splitting the personality and leaving something which cannot otherwise be born to be held by a new personality state in ourselves. This process of dissociation is how we survive the worst. It's an extraordinary human capacity, as are the other forms, less vigorous, of the repression of cognitive dissonance, the function by which we manage to subdue the internal conflict that arises from the recognition that the world is not that which we believe or hope or need that it should be. And Carr Wiley and his partner Jack and the psychotherapist unnamed are all parties who understand that lawyering involves this activity necessarily a lot. And whether we are thinking about what it takes to dissociate the reality of the harm done by the clients of the criminal defense lawyer, whose job, after all, is to provide representation to the innocent and the guilty alike, or whether it is the fact that if you really thought about the deals you do, you would know that you are harming lots of people when you do them, there is in the lawyer's practice, as Jack and Carl and the unnamed psychoanalyst all agree, there is a repetitive need to do something with the knowledge that it would be harmful fully to experience, or which at least it seems that it would be harmful fully to experience. And Wiley is unquestionably a master of not knowing what it is that he doesn't need to know in order to do the transaction he needs to do, about which he will forget when it is over. Don't ask me what it is doing to my brain. Better to be as scrupulously aware as possible of the effect of the espresso and the quality of the wine at the dinner parties, and to be as little in need of the reality of what the doing is that we are doing as he is, in order to put a couple of $1 billion into the pockets of the bankers in order to receive a couple million from them back on the sheet. This is also why, of course, it's so important to Wiley to be worried that his senior associate, really doing the deal with him, working in her 8th month of pregnancy, might have a miscarriage. He's worried about that all the time. Except, of course, that the question, should she be working at this moment, in this way, at this pace, is not actually about whether she's going to have a miscarriage in her 8th month. It's about what routinely it costs to do what he thinks she is, of course, going ultimately to be like him doing. Unlike the other associate on the deal, 6 years in, who obviously will never be able to cut it, and who therefore has no future, but how does he manage not to know that? In the large practices, the ones where you all think you're going to be the triumphant sixth-year associate who will certainly get to be a partner and who won't have to work, well, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, 10 weeks long in the eighth month of pregnancy. In the large practice, like Sebald Manning, the sixth-year associate or the seventh-year associate, the person 18 months to 2 years away from a partnership decision, has no idea how he or she or they are doing. It's the second-year associates who know. I saw it many a time in the large firm I happened to work for instead of some other large firm where it would have been equally true. Because the amount that needs to be dissociated, the news that needs to be not known in order to continue to hang in there for the chance at what has in that totalizing institution come to seem like the only thing that could possibly matter. Who has time for reading? Everybody can only have time for chasing a partnership. The news that you have to not know is so overwhelming that to a person, they don't know. The second-year associates know because they can see what's in front of their faces. It's not about them yet, and they don't have to deny it. Whether it's the partner's bathroom or the associate's bathroom, those moments of maleness in the bathroom, those should be long and deeply considered, even though they happen in seconds and they are worthless as human material for emotional involvement. They are just cruelty and indifference and tribal marking up and chimpanzee politics. And even so, it is deeply important that you remember always that they are there. When in the middle of our law practice's span of time on the 17th floor of 1995 Broadway, my business manager, Tanisha Madrid, had her second child and wanted to care for Lydia, but obviously didn't want to stay home. We simply arranged for her to bring the baby to work. Put a crib in her office, and when she and I had our morning meeting on the business affairs of the practice, as we did every single morning and still do, Lydia came along and sat on Tanisha's lap or sat on mine as we went through the numbers. And when she needed to do something else during the workday, other people looked after the baby, and mostly it was just the two of them together. And it was easy, of course. There's nothing complicated about it. Babies and workplaces have been mixing since the beginning of the human race. But when Mishy went to dine out with her friends in practice and other professional work, and all the women would talk about their childcare woes, and Mishy, who had no intention of having any children, would tell them that Eben arranged for Tanisha's baby to come to the workplace every day, and so Tanisha commutes with the baby and spends all day doing both her job and her mothering together, and the people at those dinner parties were shocked that anybody would think that it could be done. That could never happen in their workplaces, and they were right, it couldn't, but that wasn't because it couldn't work in their workplaces. It was because nobody ever wants actually to recognize what it means for people to have choices about how they live in relation to their work. The epidemic, which appears to be teaching that lesson very deeply, is actually undoing it as fast as it is threading it together, knitting during the day and unraveling at night, if we can be Homeric about it. Penelope loses either way, you see. What has actually happened in the epidemic is that the world of working women has become immeasurably tougher. Choices is not what this has all been about, of course, for anybody. But the implicit misogyny, which is just as apparent as the other biases in Carl Wiley, is just as much part of the great anthropological document that is law practice for him as for all the rest. Shana Urquhart has a pretty clear idea about what would be a decent law partner to work with. She knows one at the firm she left after working for Wiley. And what it would mean to have a minimally decent law partner to work for is not Carl Wiley's way. And since we understand what she thinks the minimum is and that he doesn't meet it, we also understand how he dealt with her. As we find ourselves here listening off stage to echoed stories, not merely of a fellow called Bartleby we might catch up with someday, but other women lawyers working for other partners, experiencing, well, this and that. Because in the end, the transactionality, which is the practice, affects the transactionality, which is the relationships, which doesn't just recapitulate other hierarchies of the past, or doesn't just involve profiteering of one sort or another on the personalities and vulnerabilities of workers, and doesn't just involve the dissociative responses to the internal conflicts created by the practice. It's all those things, and it's some other things too. Not least of which is the relationship between the transaction lawyer and the money that fuels the business of doing the running and jumping, which is mobile capital looking for places to put itself, however briefly. These human beings talking at the end of the 20th century are aware of the speeding up of the pace of the life of that form of capitalism in which they live and work. And they are aware of the decreasing ease with which the lawyers are autonomously manipulating the legal budgets of their clients. They see that business has begun regulating the way that it buys services, from floor cleaning to legal services, and is learning how to pit the suppliers of services against one another, with consequent effects on the lives of the lawyers in the large practices, from the beginning associates to the partners under pressure to produce or leave. And all of the feelings they are having on a warm summer night down by the World Financial Center, long before the resentful architecture critic Osama bin Laden smashed his airplanes into the stuff down the block, all that they are experiencing was only made more by the events of the subsequent 20 years between when they said these things and you started law school. But Wiley is a distillation, balanced in his own perfect way on the largeness of his income and the size of his pools of money and the simmering of his resentments and the efficiency with which they get the comforts and the props and the securities and the control over detail that the lenders need when big money is being lent. We're not here talking about Deutsche Bank and Donald John Trump. We're talking about serious money. And yet, from a poetic point of view, of course, this part of the poem is dedicated to Whitman, as the first part is dedicated to Kafka. And what I take from the proposition that the poet offers, I mean, to me, the reason of Carl Wiley is to provide a version of the song of myself in this poem, and yet how ironic in both the Schlegel sense and, well, what I think of as the more natural sense of the meaning of irony that is. The ecstasy of the poet in his largeness, in his ability to be a multitude, meets the constraint of the fast pace and the demanding leverage against you in the transactional practice of the late 20th century, bound in on all sides by resentment, bias, and the thirst for money. Whitman is there, as indeed he still is, on the shore of the Hudson River in a circle of incised poetry that survived the events of September 2001, and Whitman cannot be exhorted to leave the neighborhood to which he feels from his perch at the Brooklyn Eagle across the way or out of further on the island, to which he feels entitled as a young man. Gay, we should point out. Out and about in the neighborhood of the bottom of the island where all are to be found in the city. Well, he thinks it's broad-shouldered. Carl Sandburg will wish to steal that for Chicago, after all. But this, the poet's effort to provide Whitman to us in this place, on this chorus, lawyers in their late 30s, Jansen, Voorhis, and Urquhart. The poet, too, of course, indeed a little more, nearer Wiley's 55 than Wiley's 53 than Urquhart's 38, but still, people entering midlife and showing, as he shows us with his pencil, drawing them sitting there with their champagne and their hors d'oeuvres, growing into the bodily middle age, no longer with the bodies of the young, which is a gendered business altogether, as it always was, and Urquhart knows it. Yes, the subsequent years have probably cleaned up a little bit the nature of the misogyny in the conversation. Probably they don't talk that way anymore if they're still around. But they talk almost that way, and when they are boys in the locker room, of course they talk that way. And Urquhart's always known that, as you do too. But it's the need to know who's making what, the only way of keeping score. And Urquhart, who has gone to an in-house job and taken the in-house deal, which is stability for reduction of income, knows it. As her husband, the investment banker, who has not done that, knows it, and yet they, too, knowing that the big money isn't theirs, but the need for the big money is the same no matter whose child is being sent to Brown or Harvard. This was the comfort that they signed up for. This was the money that was going to change everything. You know that. And reading poetry rather than playing golf is how you figure out what that money's worth and what would be enough. And whether if at 38 you still don't know what's enough, and at 50 you still don't know what's enough, and retirement is when you have enough, then what the hell is it all about anyway? It's not as though it makes Walt Whitman out of you. We can say that for plenty sure. Robinson is not less annoying than Carl Wiley. They annoy different people in different ways. And they do not care about one another's practices. They were built of different stuff from the beginning. Society demanded different things of them to different extents and let one off easier than the other, but both of them are comfortably in the bar. Nobody is marginal to the America in which they are both working in the lower Manhattan of Wall Street dream. We have, of course, not yet started asking what the lawyers are like down there who have other roles than their two, and their two are only two, and they are men who do things in particular ways. This isn't lawyer land yet. This is merely a couple of lawyers, but I think it's valuable to reflect on what this means to us. We are readers of this poem who have a purpose in our reading. Larry was always both flattered and amused that I used this book as a material for teaching first-year law students about how to think about their lives as lawyers. This, for him, is still a poem about a place and a way of talking in it as the words ricochet off the pieces of Lower Manhattan. Oh, he's more aware than that, of course. It's partly the poet's vanity that he wishes to point out what he is building with it, which is a place, not merely a bunch of talkers in our trade.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never meet again on the bumpy road to love. Still, I'll always, always keep the memory of the way you hold your knife, the way we dance till three, the way you've changed. Can't take that away from me.
Bon Mama, do way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never meet again on the bumpy road to love. Still I always, always keep the memory of, oh, yes, the way you hold your knife, the way we dance till three, the way you change my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away from me.
Swing it, boys. But one of the central propositions that keeps coming up in our conversation, yours and mine, in the various different ways in which we're having it, is that you say to me, well, but without experience, how can I know what I will want to do, and therefore, how could I oppose what I want to do against that which groupthink tells me I am about to do and I find myself doing? Well enough and good, but the whole purpose of literature is to provide a way to have experience vicariously and to reflect upon it thoughtfully in the presence of at least one other person, namely some writer who has made it in order to allow us to think about experience the way she or he or they or it or whoever has built it up. And whether the literature we are reading is the words of the Lord God speaking classical Arabic to the Archangel Gabriel, who has delivered them to the Prophet Muhammad at the top of this Temple Mount, the Haram al-Sharif, or whether we are reading the poetry of Robert Frost or Geoffrey Chaucer or Larry Joseph, the experience of others is contained in what we read and it enters us as the language enters us, with feeling and resonance and depth that is beyond the level of our own day-to-day unreflected doing. And it reaches outside the box in which we find ourselves, however small or large, lit or lightless it may be, and gives something to reflect about which is beyond the immediate experience of the fear of the exam. Robinson says something about the pathology of civilization and the fact that lawyers are never far from evil. And Carl Wiley and his partner Jack and Jansen Voorhees and Urquhart have something to say about how we deal with the pathologies of society in which our law practice marinates us, and how dissociation, that noble and insufficient tool, catches us as we practice, as we find ourselves internally conflicted. The practice you have now causes internal conflict. You're well aware of that. The externalization of that internal conflict through either efforts to impose reform on law school or to refuse reform within oneself. Oh, we cannot do that. Everybody knows that grades matter and that 1L jobs are absolutely necessary. That process which allows us to deal with our conflicts by dismembering the nature of the conflict and putting a piece over here and a piece over there and a third piece in a trunk that can be buried in New York Harbor or left in Grand Central Station's locker rooms. That process which saves us from our traumas, which makes it possible to go on, and which at the same time means that going on is only possible for some of the parts of us, for others must stay behind and wail beside the corpse we didn't have any other way to bury. The mens fucking rea of our own private little crimes. The deals we knew hurt thousands of people and their families as we were doing them. The endless dealing with empowered misogyny and the profiteering of little boys. All the pieces that we need to put somewhere so we don't have to bear them bleeding in our hands every single day as we go on. It does no good not to know about this. It does no good to wait until experience has brought it home to you and you are sitting there with the champagne and the hors d'oeuvres. The good is to know ahead of time from the experience of others that it happens, to have felt it pulsing in you the way only a poem can make it pulse, to have incorporated these ideas, to have felt them and seen them and understood them as they are, to have gained experience by reading. And yes, indeed, Wiley is right, not the millions of pounds of paper generated in the public offerings. And not the outcome of the practicing near evil that is the source of Robinson's massive metamorphosis. Prisoners to lawyers, lawyers to prisoners, hey, presto, exacting justice. But that which is the liminal state of the intending lawyer, the one who hasn't anything to pack away yet, and who knows that the internal conflicts of law practice will be better handled consciously than by subconscious splitting. Survive we may, but thrive we won't. So let us turn the braid from how to think about our life in practice to how to think about life in law school. All counseling during the epidemic requires an effort of analysis in which, when we think about the obstacles we face, we differentiate between those common to everybody in the world of the epidemic and those idiosyncratic to ourselves. This is even harder for you now because the form of that which is common is not merely the problems of the epidemic with which everybody is in touch, but also the problems of the second semester of law school with which I am in touch and by and large you aren't. I mean by this that the forms of psychic difficulty which are characteristic of people who have turned the clubhouse turn in the first year of law school are to me part of the material against which this course is constructed. I know what happens, and over decades I made this course in order to deal with what happens. And now, for you, in the world of the epidemic in which additional other things are happening, it is not easy to know which parts are the constant parts, which parts are the general contemporary parts, and which parts are the you part of it all. But you won't be surprised to hear that, from my point of view, you have a tendency to exaggerate the you-ness of it all. Let me begin by pointing out that many people, maybe not everybody, but many, many people here, are suffering from the belief that the grades that they got in the first semester of law school somehow tell them how they ought to work. You hear, if you don't yourself feel, "Well, I thought I knew how to study, but then I came to law school and the grades I got make me think that maybe I don't understand what's good for me and I have to work a ton harder and I have to give up the ways I usually work because the grades from the fall." Now let me just one more time try to say what I have tried to say before and not done well enough in saying. First semester grades in law school are all measurements of the same irrelevant question: how fast did you become conversant in law talk? It wasn't your method of studying that determined how fast you were in uptaking law talk. Even if there were an optimal way to speed one's uptaking of law talk by immersion in the fall, it wouldn't be relevant to the task you are now performing in the spring. Therefore, the tendency to draw conclusions about how to work or how not to work based on the outcome of courses taken and exams graded in the fall is simply infeasible. You can't conclude anything about how to work in the rest of law school from what happened while you were picking up law talk by immersion in the unique term that began it all. People have tried to tell me that I'm not taking into account individual forms of... No, on the contrary, I'm exalting individual forms of how to work by telling you that whatever you think you know about how you work best is more right than anything that you could purport to learn from the grades in the first semester, which are irrelevant. Then we get into the longer-term question of why it is that I believe that the grades appearing on the law school transcript have low influence over people's subsequent career paths. A different subject, about which today let us not bother, because it's important to narrow to the first one, because now is the time when, as you begin to figure out how to work in the second term of law school, it is really important to put behind you the idea that grades told you anything from the first term of law school about how to work in the second and subsequent terms of law school. That's false. What happens in the second term of law school is that people who are now newly conversant in law talk begin to meet the standard academic demand of the rest of law school. The standard academic demand, which is not the constant, invariable, in every course, always the same way, but the bog standard form of the academic demand of law school is, here's a bunch of documents, cases and materials, bunch of reading. Read all this and consolidate a theory of the case, a general understanding of the subject in its trunk and in its branches and in its twigs and in its leaves, such that on a certain day you can walk into a social situation, this one happening to be called an exam, and asked a bunch of superficial questions of stereotypic kinds, to which you respond on the basis of the consolidated knowledge you possess. That's the task. That's not the task of every kind of course or every kind of learning. That's not the task of every kind of learning of the law. It's not the task in a good law school course, but it's the task in law school anyway. Here's a bunch of stuff. Consolidate your understanding of it. Here's a theory of the case. Walk in on an arbitrary day and answer shallow questions with some evident mastery. When I say that by the third term in law school, you will know that you can do that job sufficiently well to provide whatever level of performance on the exam you desire within a compressed period of reading time, people tell me, but you're not taking account of everybody's differences. And I'm not denying anybody's differences. It has nothing to do with how students are. It has to do with how exams are. Law school exams are stereotypical, shallow, superficial entities. You know the forms of cliche question, the issue spotter and the policy question and the right and opinion question. In other words, forms are few and exceedingly stereotypical and easy to produce. Perhaps if someone walked up and put a gun to your head and demanded a villanelle, you wouldn't know how. But if somebody walks up and demands that you answer an issue spotter, you don't have to first figure out what an issue spotter is or what the rules are. In my first year torts course, I walked into the exam and I discovered a lengthy issue spotter made by Peter Schuck for the first time, a first year teacher making an issue spotter. Though the torts teachers had obviously ganged up a little bit on this one. And it concerned some back-to-the-land cult that went from New York to rural Vermont to fish and live simply and etc., except they built a fish cannery, which no back-to-the-land bunch would do, and they started canning fish out of the lake, and the fish in the cans was bad, and people got sick who ate it, including the children of the people, and now the question is, assess the rights and liabilities, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at this issue spotter, and I wrote the okay, here I am, but I will now answer the issues, and I dropped a footnote. And I said, for the purposes of this answer, I assume that the state of Vermont has not abolished intrafamilial tort immunities, period. This is the ne plus ultra of time-saving assumptions, period. And then I didn't have to write any of the crap about the children who got sick from eating the tainted fish, because if Vermont hadn't abolished any intrafamilial immunities, then there was no way they could sue their parents, etc., and I could just leave it out. And that left a good deal of time for whatever the other rubbish was on the exam. And naturally, it was not possible for Peter to mark me down on it because I had seen the issue. I had simply written two sentences in order to avoid having to write 18 sentences, which was how I became his research assistant in due course, as I have previously mentioned. In other words, when you have a theory of the case, the course in this instance, right, a theory of what there was in it and what you consolidated out of all the stuff you were given, and you walk in and you put your theory to work, you're doing what law students now must do in the bog standard, usual, low intellectual demand thing that is the law school course exam. I haven't given exams since before the lawyers in this most recent episode in Lawyerland were sitting out there with their champagne and their hors d'oeuvres. I stopped giving exams before they started with those hors d'oeuvres. Because, of course, it's all very dumb. It's not a good way to do anything, but is the way that it is done around you, and it is usually to your advantage, and today, now, in this term, especially so. So let us come to that. In addition to the first semester not having modeled for you what you should know about your own habits of learning, which are just as good as they used to be, and nothing that happened in the fall term via the grades that you received measuring how quick you uptook law talk can change that. It is also true that the system that prepares you to worry about these exams has, as I keep telling you, collapsed. Zoom school is still what they are doing because they don't know what else to do. But Zoom school doesn't work, and everybody now is dissociating that. Because they didn't know it wouldn't work before. They never thought about it. Everybody was taken by surprise at this entirely foreseeable problem. And so they invented Zoom school because video conferencing makes it simplest for teachers to give sort of the course they've always given before without changing it. And since they had no experience with the use of low-quality commodity video conferencing for teaching law school, they didn't know it wouldn't work, but now they do, and still there's nothing to be done about it except to tinker around the edges. And so everybody is backpedaling fast while also dissociating the backpedaling, hoping that they can continue into a fall term which will still be like this while still doing that which they know doesn't work without experiencing the sense of failing as teachers, which is the inevitable consequence of doing what you know is hurting students, which is not what teachers want to do. Therefore, even more than usual, it is your theory of the case which will be dominant when the time comes. When you walk confidently into the exam, which doesn't exist for walking into anymore, when you walk in and make your statement what this course is to you, and you put a bunch of stuff in the blue books which shows that you know what you're talking about, that it is to you what you say it is, because you've read and thought, you will get deferred to more than under ordinary circumstances, which is ordinarily enough. When I was in law school, I took exams all the time. And when I took exams, I had an invariable practice concerning them. First, I walked in and picked up the exam paper. If the exam was being given in a classroom rather than being a take-home exam, then I walked into the classroom with the copy of the exam. I read the questions once, carefully. I put the paper down on the desk in the classroom, and I went out for a walk. My favorite place of walking was the Grove Street Cemetery across the street from Yale Law School. By walking into the Grove Street Cemetery and walking up and down the lanes among the graves, I could give myself a quarter of an hour to consolidate my view of what these questions offered me, what things I could put in the various parts of the questions that would be answered in the way I wanted to answer them, And to give my sense and to give myself an overall sense of the exam I was about to write with some outlines in my mind. After a quarter of an hour or so of walking in the Grove Street Cemetery, or equivalently, the 12-minute walk back from the law school to my apartment, if it was a take-home exam, I could then sit down and write. The idea that there is a big time constraint in law school exams, this 4 hour, oh my God, it's just wrong. The exam is not, despite the self-regard of the teacher who created it, the exam is not difficult. It's a bunch of stereotypical questions to be answered out of material you have fully consolidated. Whatever that material may be, there may be other things you didn't read and haven't consolidated. So what? You have more than enough material to answer all the questions excellently, and provided that you don't need to spend a lot of time worrying and aren't slowed down in the process by fear that you're not doing it right, there's ample time. Ample enough, indeed, that to begin by declaring that it is you who are in charge of the timing of the exam, not the fucking teacher, is a very good place to start. And of course, that was part of what was going on when I laid the exam down on the desk in the classroom and went out for the walk. It's my exam, not your exam. I'm thinking. Leave me alone. But everything is very sped up, and the demands are very great, and the confinement of the epidemic is very strict, and the sense of social isolation is very bitter. And it is easy to believe that you are not the one in control. And if somebody comes along and tells you that you are the one in control, it's easy to, well, dissociate that away. Even to oppose it vehemently. Because, well, because that is what we do. Because we're human. But the goal is learning and the enjoyment of learning. And even, and I do mean even, the examination can be a moment of both. Provided, that is, that you're in control of it. Otherwise, it cannot be either. And it is that which makes the fear. And it's the fear which makes the internal conflict, and it's the internal conflict which makes the split. And the drugs, whatever they may be, from the caffeine to the Merlot to the iced spring water to the cocaine to the whiskey, the drugs are just a way of making that split feel less tearing. Talk to you soon.